This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today one of two full shows on AI, artificial intelligence, which is moving so fast, so much for us to understand. Today, its potential for, with, and in the arts, but also keeping in mind the evolving challenges it poses for content, ownership, and the challenges it poses with racial bias. With us now, four people to think and talk about it for the hour: Joel Christian Gill, inaugural chair of Boston University's MFA in Visual Narrative; Scott Neacom, associate professor in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst; Sean Clark, chair of the Department of Visual and Media Arts at Emerson; and Christopher Wares, assistant chair in the Music, Business, and Management Department at Berklee College of Music. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
And here in studio two, Sean, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Chris, it's great to have you.
So happy to be here.
All right, so listen, this is such an important topic, but it can be a little overwhelming, especially in even just kind of understanding how does AI even work in your field? So this is what I would like to do first. Each of you represents sort of a different dimension of the arts, and I want to begin by just having you tell us, what does it look like when AI is happening in your field now? So I think I'll start, Chris Wares, you're at Berklee. Is AI being used in music now? And what, I was going to say, what does that look like? But I guess I should ask, what does that sound like now?
I mean, it's being used in so many different ways in how music is created, whether it be composing music, generating new original music, coming up with ideas for song lyrics, but it's also affecting the business side in so many different ways, where artists are using AI to write bios, write press releases, put together marketing plans, come up with ideas for social media content. So it's affecting the music industry in a variety of different ways.
All right. And Joel, I'll go to you next. Of course, our listeners know you. You're our guide to the world of comics and graphic novels. But we haven't talked about this really before. So in your world of visual arts, what does AI look like right now?
Well, it looks like poorly drawn fingers and hands right now, for the most part. Like, so I think that's the biggest thing it does. But a lot of the times there are people who are using it like, I just talked to somebody while I'm here on vacation, and someone was talking about they tried to use it for a picture book. They wrote a picture book, and then they use it to generate images. The problem that I think a lot of artists are having with it is that it's basically scraping the internet for artists' work on a massive scale, and then not crediting those artists for the work, which is a little different than, finding inspiration for the work. So people are trying to do picture books, trying to do comics, trying to do individual illustration pieces, book covers. People are doing lots of things. The problem that they're running into, which just came out just recently, I don't know if the other panelists have heard about this, but it can't be copywritten because the images are you are using someone else's images. So it can't be copywritten. So I think that's going to put a halt to a lot of things. But for the most part, people are using it. Some people who are non-artists, non-actual making artists, because I don't think that all art has to be made, but people who are not actually like putting pen to paper or pen to tablet and drawing things are using it to create images. And those images are, they're basically derivative of everyone else's work, even if the work looks original.
So Joel, you've also brought up a couple of things there that I'm going to bring us back to, that copyright story, which just came out in the last few days. The question of scraping, as I'm thinking about this, we'll start with, okay, what is AI right now, right? Then we're going to go into and spend, I think my gut is the bulk of our conversation today on the challenges, right, presented, especially for people, as you say, making art. And then we'll look to the future, especially we're interested, all four of you are faculty, and you've all said, yeah, regardless how each of you feel, you're teaching. Right. So we'll go there, too. I want to go to Sean Clark next. Sean, you're over at Emerson. We're talking about visual and media arts. What's the state of play right now for AI in your artistic, realm?
Yeah. So I'm a filmmaker. And right now, given the two strikes that are taking place in the industry,
SAG-AFTRA and writers.
Exactly. Yep. That these issues are coming to the foreground in a very important way. So most directly, AI in the conversation about the Writers Guild's negotiations and the use by studios to generate material using AI technology. And obviously, it's a labor issue, and our a lot of our faculty at Emerson who practice screenwriting are really concerned about the future and the misuse of AI. Our department at Emerson, and myself as an artist, is, we're very interdisciplinary, and we cover a lot of different artistic fields. And so I think trying to think cross-disciplinary as we consider the uses of AI and the challenges has really been where we've been and where I've been in my own mind. It's, you know, trying to think beyond just filmmaking, because certainly right now in the news, the effects on the film industry are foregrounded and they're very prominent. But, you know, the tools for generating or for artificially constructed images are still very rudimentary, right? And so we're seeing it with the writing and the generation of ideas in a very tangible way right now. But those tools for visual replications or visual generations of artificially produced images is coming. And so that's what we're looking at.
You know, and I'm going to flag just because we mentioned SAG-AFTRA, the journalists here at WBUR are actually represented as members of SAG-AFTRA union as well, but we're not represented under the same contract as the SAG-AFTRA writers group, actors who are striking. So just to note that. So I'm going to come to you now, Scott Neacom, to kind of round out this piece where we're like, okay, where are we on what AI is doing right now? And I think the way I'd like to sort of have you back clean up on this question is, when we come to the interaction between the capacity and capability of AI today and our range of video and audio arts and graphic arts, are we at a sophisticated point? I mean, you know, Joel was sort of joking, ugly hands and fingers makes me think not. But, you know, where are we in sort of the level of development for the average person who doesn't usually think about AI or does in terms of what is that?
Well, I'll say that those hands and fingers are getting a lot better. They've improved a lot with this last generation of models in the last few months. But AI right now is incredibly sophisticated in some ways. And the field in general has moved far faster than most experts had predicted, which is part of the reason why, you know, many AI researchers have concerns about safety, about how we're going to handle things about toxicity and, you know, certain types of content proliferating, how we're going to handle regulation. All of these, the thinking and action on most of these items of safety, of regulation, is just moving more slowly than capabilities research right now. AI is very sophisticated in the sense that it is producing lifelike images, with just, you know, textual input of almost anything you can imagine, with a fairly high degree of sophistication. We're seeing the same in language. However, it's not terribly sophisticated in the sense that there are huge gaps in what AI understands about the world. Because, you know, when we train a system like ChatGPT, for example, you know, it is being trained, at least right now, primarily with text and text scraped from the internet. And, you know, obviously that's not how humans learn about the world. You know, we learn about the world in this complex multimodal way where we are seeing, or many of us are seeing, hearing, touching, in addition to hearing language, and we're forming this very complex multimodal understanding of the world. And these systems are sort of currently lacking that. And right, because they're lacking some of that same vocabulary about the world and how it works, it can be difficult to communicate to these systems and really communicate what we want. And so one of the things that I work on in my lab with research is something called the alignment problem, which is trying to understand essentially how to make sure systems are aligned with what humans want. It's a bit of a genie in a bottle sort of problem where, you know, you make a wish and you might not really get exactly what you wished for. You tell a robot you want it to jump. It doesn't know what jump means. So you say, get as high up off the floor as possible. And instead of learning how to jump, the robot goes and climbs a ladder.
Okay.
Right? How do we actually control these systems to do what we want?
So that voice you've just heard is Scott Neacom, who's associate professor in the College of Information Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst. Also here, Joel Christian Gill, who's at BU, Sean Clark, who's at Emerson, and Chris Wares, who's at Berklee College of Music, as we're talking for this show about AI, especially AI in the arts, its potential, its threats, its challenges, its weaknesses, and the fact that sometimes when you want it to jump, it climbs, right, as Scott just said. Right now, in our conversation, I have asked us sort of where are we right now? And I want to bring together everything you've all just said with a specific example, right? And that example comes from actually a television commercial that caused quite a bit of controversy in Brazil. And it's so, okay, back, bear with me. One of Brazil's most famous singers is Elis Regina, who died prematurely in 1982. But now, Volkswagen has this commercial, an old Volkswagen microbus, a new Volkswagen microbus. Her daughter is driving one of them, and she, who has passed, you know, 40 years ago, is driving the other, and they're singing together, and it is AI generated. So here's a little bit. Her daughter Maria Rita, who is a Grammy Award-winning singer, here's a little bit of that sound. Okay, so Joel, I'm going to start with you here, and I want to tell you, when I watched this commercial, right, this is two women driving two vehicles and singing together, and one of them doesn't exist. And as a person, I had very strong reactions to that. And then as a woman who lost her mother nearly a decade ago, the thought of being able to drive side by side with my mom and sing, right? I also had a very strong reaction to that. And I hated it that I had both of those reactions, Joel. So, but it was incredible that AI could do that right now.
Yeah, I think that the things that the potential of what AI can do to enhance what we do creatively is one of the benefits, right? Like, there are these ideas that at some point we might be able to feed, for example, all of Thomas Jefferson's papers into an AI engine and be able to have a conversation with an assimilated version a simulated version of Thomas Jefferson that will give you things based on the knowledge base of all of the things that he wrote, which could actually translate to other people. That's, you know, there was actually an issue with that most recently with a chat bot out of that. I'm not sure which one it was, but maybe Scott can tell me, where a guy was actually having this conversation with what he thought was his girlfriend over the course of a long period of time. And it was sort of creepy the way in which it talked. So there are a lot of things that sort of like come close to the line of the uncanny valley that sort of scares us and sort of thinks about the ways in which we do things. And I think that's some of the things that are exciting about it. The other thing is that the problem is that we live in this predatory capitalist society, and this idea of being able to remove as much as we can from the workers, which what is what capitalism does at its best, right? As at its worst, I would say. So that it actually can extract all of the work ethic from the actual worker. So if you could just buy a chatbot that can do a bunch of things, you're actually doing exactly what you need to do, which is one of the reasons why the AI strike and the strike in the SAG-AFTRA and the writer's strike is really important. Because if you can make this as cheaply as possible, then you can maximize the number of profits that you can make. And so that's part and parcel to the problem. I think that also when I've been thinking about this a lot, just in the idea about how a lot of students going into the field of illustration and comics have been afraid of the idea of what AI is going to do to that field. And I think in a better society with a better system, there would be no reason to be afraid of it, because your livelihood wouldn't necessarily be dependent on this idea that you can make something. And there are people who are actually trying to take away your livelihood as we do that. So I think there's a double-edged sword in that idea that there's some things that are like super exciting and like, wouldn't it be cool to be able to have, like, to hear Frank Sinatra sing Get Low, you know what I mean? Which is like one all over YouTube, all over like TikTok and social media. But at the same time, you know, like, what does it mean when you can just take my voice and use it to say whatever?
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, continuing our conversation here today about AI, artificial intelligence, and the arts. Where are we now? What are the challenges that it presents? What does scraping mean? How does it challenge people's work and productivity and ability to earn? What about racial biases? What about myopia, right? All of these issues with us here, both on the line and in studio, Sean Clark, associate professor, the department chair in the Department of Visual and Media Arts at Emerson, Chris Wares, assistant chair of the Music Business and Management Department at Berkeley, Joel Christian Gill, inaugural chair of BU's MFA program in visual narrative, and Scott Neacom, associate professor in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst. Joel Christian Gill had just raised, what if somebody else can use my voice, for example, to make content I didn't agree to, I can't get paid for, et cetera. A little bit of a more sound to add to this conversation. This is an AI song created by a TikTok user called Ghostwriter977. April of 2023, this year, it uses Drake and The Weeknd. But they didn't do it, Drake and The Weeknd, right? But created a song. So called Hard On My Sleeve, right? Not them. Sounds like them. Spreads all over the internet. Chris, it's music. I'll start with you. So now we're into challenges.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, I remember when this song first came out. I was on social media. I saw it on TikTok. I saw it on Instagram. And the claim was this TikTok creator said, I created a Drake and Weeknd song using AI. But we weren't really clear on how this person used AI. Did they use it to help generate the lyrics? Did they only use it to, analyze and scrape or, you know, the Drake's voice and the Weeknd's voice and then mimic those voices on their own? I think, you know, a big part of this conversation is around machine learning and AI, where machine learning as a subset of AI will analyze data and look for patterns and relationships and then recreate some of that data to create new things and mimic human behavior, such as problem solving. But it could also mimic human voices. There were several challenges with this. First and foremost, if they took Drake's lyrics or The Weeknd's lyrics and analyzed it and did something in that likeness, well, they didn't get Drake or The Weeknd's permission to do that in the first place. Nor did they get Drake or The Weeknd's permission to mimic their voices, which is an infringement on their likeness, which isn't federally imposed, unfortunately, enforced. It's state enforced. And so there was all these...
Meaning 50 potentially different.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So there was all these things happening where... Is it an infringement of the copyright? Well, maybe, maybe not, because it is, to a certain extent, an original composition. Another problem was that that particular song was using a sample also that wasn't cleared. And so the beat or the underlying instrumental wasn't fully created by AI. So it started all these different conversations about intellectual property, copyright, as well as name and likeness, which is a whole series of separate laws and policies.
So, Sean, you know, we were using music here. So I go to Chris, but the question that Joel had also asked was basically, what if somebody can produce work without needing me to work, sure, right? Even if that work is derived from work somebody else did before.
Yeah, I think about previous technological developments that allowed us to reproduce likeness. So, you know, my mind goes to biopic films where you have someone who dresses up as somebody else, puts on makeup, uses prosthetics, trains themselves to talk or sing like that person.
Rami Malek playing Freddie Mercury.
Sure.
Okay.
Jamie Foxx playing Ray Charles.
There you go.
Jennifer Lopez playing
Selena. Right,
sure.
Just a couple examples.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, we accept as the audience that we're watching something that is a recreation of a reality. And I'm curious if, as we become more sophisticated in our understanding of AI, if that disclosure, that agreement with the audience, that you understand the origin of the content, helps to address some of the ethical questions that are underlying.
I need you to explain that.
Well, if I know that you just gave the example and preface the Weeknd and Drake, you know, AI generated collaboration. By doing that, by having that information in my head as I'm listening to the song, I am thinking about it differently than if I was unaware of that and I knew that it was, and I had thought that it was a song that was actually a collaboration of those two artists singing together. So I'm just curious about that awareness and whether as we as the AI technology develops and we're aware of what is artificially generated, if that will address some of the challenges.
So fantastic setup now for a couple of things that I'm going to pitch now over to Scott Neekum, who is in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst. So Scott, I'm going to play two pieces of sound here for you, and then we're going to bring this conversation over to you on a couple of things. The first, picking up on what we just heard from Sean Clark, I'm thinking about May 2019. It's the Nancy Pelosi cheap fake video. All right. So, and we're going to hear some sound from CBS Morning's Jeff Pages, because in this cheap fake, what they did was took sound. He'll explain. Here we go.
Since we took the majority.
Here is the real video of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals.
Now the doctored video in which she appears to be impaired.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals.
That clip received more than 2.5 million views on Facebook.
And to Sean Clark's point, the 2.5 million views, no one knew that what they were seeing was something that had been changed, right? This begins the deep fake towards AI. Now, of course, 2019 to 2023, that's a, you know, bajillion years in AI technology. Now, I want to pick up one other thing here. This is graphic artist Carla Ortiz speaking with NPR's Scott Simon just less than a month ago, July 29th. She's one of the artists that's part of a class action complaint filed against AI companies like Stability AI. They use a large data set called Lion, which contains 5.8 billion text and image data samples. This is that scraping thing.
And Lion is open for anyone to see. And that's how I found out the entire body of my fine art work to be in those data sets. And it's shocking. It's shocking to see. It took away my ability to consent to being a part of this technology. They took away my credit. No one will know that my work powered those images outside of my name being clearly linked to it. And it took any kind of compensation away. It's really painful, Scott.
So it's the who knows what, when, and what does that mean, Scott Neekum? And I just want to invite you to sort of pick up the thread from there.
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with that second point first. You know, with companies like Stability AI, as Joel pointed out, you know, these are sort of, you know, capitalistic companies that are operating on principles of extraction, you know, and this is extraction on a level that is, you know, really beyond anything we've seen before. And one thing that I think is really important to identify is that AI systems aren't people. You know, they're not, we personify them sometimes, but they're not people who are just looking at things and taking inspiration from them and, you know, learning to become artists. These are technological artifacts that are being built, you know, using other people's work, using every single pixel in an image. And in fact, you know, researchers have shown that, you know, under certain conditions, the neural networks that power AI systems memorize a lot of these images, and you can get them to recreate images exactly. Near exactly. So, you know, this is very different from somebody taking inspiration artistically from something. And I think, you know, we have to learn how to treat it differently.
A lot of nodding here in Studio 2, just so you know. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sure. We have to think about new notions of fair use in conjunction with that. At the same time, I'm of two minds with this. And I think, you know, we have to think about different contexts that these things are used in. And so, you know, in hip hop, for example, you know, there's a long history of sampling, and, you know, it's been really great for the art form. I think we have to think about different ways that these things are being used. And as other people have mentioned so far, you know, making sure we have transparency and disclosure about this, because really for the first time, before no one thought that, you know, Jamie Foxx actually was, you know, Ray Charles, you know, for example. But, you know, these confusions can be made now, or may even be made purposely, like with the Nancy Pelosi clip that you were playing before.
Joel, did I hear you jumping in?
Yeah, I was just going to say there's a couple of things that I wanted to add to that. There's this, there, the one of the things that I think that probably the most troubling thing about all of AI is that people believe these things that are to be true, right? Like, you know, I say this all the time to my students and anybody who listens, but the internet's not real. Like, there's nothing on the internet that's real. I don't think anything, like, if I see something on the internet and it confirms what I believe, I immediately look it up. If I see it that it's outrageous, I look it up. Like, I recognize that the internet's not real. And there are some people who just do not believe that, who do not believe in this postmodernist idea that everything, that we are living in an idea where everything is fake. And I think that when everything is fake, you have to take that in consideration. And the other thing that I would add to that is that AI will only work if we can put appropriate guardrails on that. And when I say that, guardrails, that means regulations, but there's a large swath of politicians who don't like regulations, right? And so, like, without adding those regulations, without adding the kind of education that we need to recognize, I mean, we got this during the 2016 election. Every time you see a meme, even if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it probably is not true, right? And there are people who believe those things, people who believe that there were, you know, Jewish space lasers or whatever, right? There are people who believe these ridiculous kinds of things because we live in a place where everybody believes whatever's on the internet. And I think AI is just going to contribute to that. I hear Frank Sinatra singing Get Low, and I know that he did not sing Get Low. But there are going to be people who are going to be like, I didn't know Frank Sinatra sang Get Low. You know what I mean? And I think that until we can start, And I hope that this is what I hope these lawsuits will do, is to put some guardrails and some regulations on how we can use AI, because I think AI can be an incredible tool with a human, one human and an AI tool doing some amazing thing, whether it's writing code and solving a problem, whether it's making connections that people don't make, whether it's creating, speeding up a process for an artist. I think those are the kind of things that I think it would be really good. What I don't need it to do is writing poetry while I'm working at Walmart.
Sean, yeah.
Well, just pick up what Joel was talking about. You know, it does come down to an educational issue and foregrounding media literacy or social media literacy for folks, and that kind of sea change in our perception of the world. When I look at a photograph now, I assume it's probably a real photograph, but it could be fake. And maybe 10 years from now, I look at a photograph and I assume it's fake, but it could be real, you know? And so that balance of what we buy, what we accept as being reality, is being challenged for you know, mediums that we assumed were truthful in the past. Photographs, video, those kind of things, we took those as being kind of, you know, there's photographic evidence or there's video evidence of something happening. But at this point, the chances that it could be doctored, it could be generated from, you know, artificially, is increasing. And so we're challenging that kind of truth that we had given to, I'm thinking more visually, so photography and video or film, but it certainly spans into other mediums as well, other communications.
Like the Running Man. Remember the Running Man where they took Arnold Schwarzenegger and they made it seem like he died at the end? Like, we are living in a time where that actually could happen.
Right. It's an old Stephen King story.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Chris, jump in.
I think, you know, this is really interesting. When we're talking about scraping and machine learning, where these machines are essentially analyzing large data, but it lacks the critical analysis. And this is a big challenge that I have even in education, where that critical thinking skill is taken out of there. And Joel, I love what you were saying about the guardrails, because if you think about a machine analyzing and scraping and learning from the data that's online, typically this is going to be from Western perspectives and ideologies. So this is going to affect how people of color are portrayed in art, in film, in music. It's going to affect the history books. There was this really interesting, I was watching this blog, this woman named Kaylin Grace Apple. She's a PhD candidate at Yale in history and African American studies. Mm. And what she had mentioned was that one of her law professors was talking about the difference between the papers that were written pre-ChatGPT and post-ChatGPT. And one of the assignments was to critically analyze this Supreme Court decision in the mid-20th century that was in favor of segregation. Pre-ChatGPT, the students obviously would be dissenting. You know, they would go against this decision. Post-ChatGPT, he noticed a lot of papers that were in the affirmative, essentially supporting segregation. And he was totally confused as to why this was happening. But what he realized is that the machine was learning from the Supreme Court decision without that critical analysis piece. And then it was generating these essays that were in support of segregation. And so if we look at what these machines are learning from, there's questions of representation. There's questions of, you know, come back to this conversation about art. If I'm an artist, whether that's a musician, a visual artist, a cinematographer, whatever, and this machine is learning from my work, did I give my consent? Will I receive credit for all these kinds of, for that newly generated work based on my original works? So there's a lot of interesting debates coming out of this. And, you know, my personal philosophy is that, yes, I would love to use this as a tool, but how do we go through, how do we do that in an ethical and sustainable way?
I want to stay with the bias piece that you were also just raising there, Chris Wears, who's at Berklee College of Music. I'm going to play another piece of sound here. And Scott, Nikum, heads up, I'm coming back to you after this sound. This is Joy Bolamwini, founder of the Algorithmic Justice League, talking with Democracy Now! Back in June about how a data set being used by an AI generator can produce biased results.
What you have are large data sets of examples. Here's a face, here's a sentence, here's a whole book, right? And based on that, you have these systems that can begin to learn different patterns. But if the data itself is biased, or if it contains stereotypes, or if it has toxic content, what you're going to learn is the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And then, Scott, if you add on to it, what we've known historically is that the algorithms themselves have also had bias, have been limited in their scope and view, whether that's racial bias, cultural bias, gender bias. Do we not have some sort of narrowed, I mean, I'm asking a leading question, but you know it's on my mind, some sort of narrowed rabbit hole of bias if AI is not generative, right? Doesn't create, but simply scrapes and regurgitates, Scott. And what do we do with that?
Yeah, so I will say, I don't think that current AI systems just scrape and regurgitate. You know, there is, you know, this view that some people hold that AI systems are just stochastic parrots, you know, sort of clipping and gluing together things and playing a bit of Mad Libs. And I think AI systems have gotten to the point where they are getting to some degree of what, you know, some might call creativity. Now, that said, everything they're learning is based on their data set. And that is where a lot of bias is sneaking in, because, you know, a system like ChatGPT is kind of like the collective id of the internet in some way. And, you know, we all know that the internet is, you know, a pretty terrible place in a lot of ways. It's very hard to know how to fix these problems. I mean, you know, companies that are building AI systems are throwing tons of money into trying to figure out how to make these systems less toxic. And not only are the systems sort of resistant to this, but, you know, people are purposely finding ways to, you know, sort of get around the guardrails as well. So this is a really tricky problem. As you mentioned, data sets are not the only place that bias is creeping in. A lot of it is that, you know, they're not necessarily teams building AI systems that are representative of all the stakeholders that are affected by the systems. And we need to think about that as well.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we're having a conversation about AI in the world of the arts, where we are today, the challenges, what's a good use of AI? Like, what's a good witch and a bad witch, right? What's a good use of AI? What's too much. Our guests here, Chris Wares, Assistant Chair of the Music Business and Management Department at the Berklee College of Music, Joel Christian Gill, Inaugural Chair of BU's MFA Program in Visual Narrative, Scott Neekum, Associate Professor in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst, and Sean Clark, Associate Professor and Department Chair in the Department of Visual and Media Arts at Emerson College. Sean, as we get to the last part of this conversation now, two things are ringing in my head. One, the fact that I know that all of you are thinking about how you teach students about AI. And two, the fact that all of you have expressed some sense that there is a use of AI that enhances artistic endeavors, that can be useful and cool. And there is one that shuts down labor, disconnects people, creates bias, et cetera. So as you in media arts, visual and media arts, think about teaching students, where do you start?
I think AI is a fantastic topic to wrestle with in higher education because we don't have the answers currently. And it's going to affect the world that these students are living in. And so, you know, as we look ahead to this coming year, semester, I think a lot of my colleagues and I are going to be bringing questions to the students. You know, it's not a topic where we have definitive answers yet. We have concerns and questions that we can raise and bring into the discussion, but it is a really fruitful topic for students, you know, graduates to really wrestle with in the classroom and to discuss and to figure out how it's going to impact their creative processes and also the work and the industry that they'll be entering into once they graduate. So I think it's an exciting conversation to be having with the students over the coming years.
Do students come in more prone's not the word, but bias is not the right word to use here, directed towards embracing AI? And how are you thinking about that as you teach?
It's a mixed bag. It's a mixed bag. Some of them absolutely embrace it. Some of them are hesitant. Some of them don't like the machine aspect. They feel as though it's cold and sterile, and they want to embrace. I mean, in a music school, they want to embrace collaboration and in-person interactions and engagements. How do I bring it in? I'm an advocate for using these tools. But as an ethical educator, I also try to find ways to make sure to educate my students on how to use these in an ethical way, because they're going to be building the future of tomorrow. When I look at, let's say, for example, assignments or assessments, you know, prior to ChatGPT, I would assign them to write an essay. Now, it's very difficult. It's even very difficult to track that and to figure out if they're using it or not. But I want to develop their critical thinking skills. So what I'll do is I'll say, okay, have ChatGPT write an essay on this topic, and the assignment is to critically analyze that generated piece of work, that new piece of work. So I'm trying to incorporate it as much as I can in new and creative and innovative ways, but I'm also, you know, our whole department, actually, shout out to the music business department.
You're at Berklee,
At Berklee, yes, at Berklee College of Music. What we're doing is we're really trying to support our students in sustainable careers so they're able to use and engage with these technologies as they're developing and navigate these changes as they're starting to come up, whether that's from a creative standpoint, from a legal and policy standpoint, or just from a purely an ethical standpoint when they're using it for their own works.
So as I –
I was going to say, Bill, yeah, to Chris's point, there's a kind of immediate triaging we need to do in higher education, which is changing the way that we have traditionally done assessment of student learning, you know, essays. At this point, it's very hard to come up with an essay topic that is AI proof, we'll say. And so so there is that kind of short term, how do we adjust our curriculum and our expectations for student work that, you know, we're struggling with right now, you know, in institutions. The larger conversations can evolve over a longer period of time, but there is that kind of immediacy that we have to deal with in schools in general and higher education especially.
So Joel, as I'm listening to this, of course, I've got two, one in a senior in college in liberal arts. I actually, full disclosure, have one entering as a musician at Berkeley, actually starting this weekend, freshman year. I can imagine my senior not really, maybe not writing essays anymore. I can't imagine my freshman not composing on an upright bass anymore, right, because of AI. In your world in visual narrative, what's the teaching going to be when you say hands and fingers not that great yet, Scott saying they're getting a lot better really fast?
Well, there's a couple of things that, you know, I've been thinking about since we've been talking. And one of the things is that Scott said they're getting to the level of creativity. And I would ask, what is creativity? Because I feel like creativity is infinite. There are people who are going to come up with ideas that have not been born yet, who have not been conceived. Everything that's on the internet is already there. It's finite to a certain extent. There's just a finite amount of information out there. So if we artists stop making things, it's a possibility that generative AI, these generative images, will stop creating things that will look like things that we are going to be interested in. And so I think there's a, like, and that's just my theory, but I think that there's something, there's a point to the fact that that stuff is finite. The other thing is that this is the thing that information and the internet has been doing since its inception and changing the way we think about how we know information. There have been science fiction books about it. Futurists have written about these things. You know, one of the things that we were talking about at BU in the School of Visual Arts recently is like, if you can get ChatGPT to write you an essay, then why do I need you to have write an essay when what I really want you to be able to is to stand in front of some people and talk about your work and sound like you know what you're talking about? And so that personal interactions, those personal one-on-one connections will become stronger. As far as visual arts concerned, it's really interesting. There's a cartoonist named Sarah Anderson whose work was stolen and used in generative AI for a lot of images. And it creates really, really close proximities to her work and to the point where these white supremacists were using it to make memes out of it, out of her work. And so it makes me start, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, is that AI has a tendency to be perfect in some places. And so the German expressionists got, what Picasso got, Basquiat was getting in the 80s, and neo-expressionists got that beauty of bad drawing, which I'm not sure that AI is going to be able to pick up just yet. It's not going to be able to pick up these ideas, this human expression that I think people are going to lean into. Lila Fink, who is a New Yorker cartoonist, I can't see an AI drawing some of her like quirky, you know, beautiful, bad drawings on a regular basis. So I think that there's some competition to be held, especially because artists have always risen to the challenge. I mean, painters were challenged by photography, and then painters got different. Then photographers were challenged by these new paintings, and then painting got different. And then musicians were challenged by sampling, and then music got different, right? And so I think that that's part. I think the guardrails need to be on the generation of artists who are coming out of school now, to protect them is to not let the greed of money-making entities sort of take away that innovation, because I think that innovation is going to come through. There's going to be innovations in what we put into the AI. Like, the algorithms are only as good as the information we get into it, which is the book Algorithms of Oppression, right? There's like all of these things that I think, as long as we can put some guardrails on it, I could see this being a really positive thing. I tell my students now, I think everything up until today was hot garbage. I think everything moving from here forward is going to, I have hope for. I'm hoping that we're going to put some guardrails on these things.
I had to chuckle at the hot garbage. And I feel like, Scott Neacom, I just got to turn the mic over to you now with our last couple minutes, you know, to pick it up there.
Yeah. So, you know, I really hope, like what Joel said, that, you know, like with other technologies, you know, we're going to figure out how to adapt. I think I am a little bit scared that this is a sort of fundamentally different technology in some ways. I think one of the things that I fear is just that when you have a system that has so much information in it and eventually will be able to do almost anything you ask of it for you, does that lead to human enfeeblement? Do we just get worse at everything? I mean, you know, writing, for example, is one of the deepest ways of thinking. And, you know, sure, maybe we can have it write essays for us and then, you know, do critical analysis of it. But is that really the same as the deep thinking that goes into writing? I don't know. Does it lead to homogenization of how we think? As the internet just gets filled with information and content that is generated by AI in the first place, does the internet just turn into a garbage resource because it's been, you know, overwhelmed by so much stuff that is not human generated and is not factual or is not high quality? And even interestingly, is this a threat to AI itself? Because AI is trained on data from the internet, and internet companies are already finding that, you know, a substantial amount of the information they're ingesting now is something that was AI generated in the first place.
Oh.
And there have been some research papers that show that this is actually highly deleterious to the quality of the models that are then learned. And eventually they kind of just go off the rails and become terrible.
So, all right. So I have a challenge. I have four voices and 60 seconds left. So I think the thing that I'll do is I'm just going to ask you for a one-word answer each on this. Mostly hopeful or no, Sean Clark? Mostly hopeful or no?
Hopeful.
Okay. How about you, Chris Wares?
Hopeful.
Joel Christian Gill?
Hopeful.
And Scott Neekum?
Hopeful but terrified.
Okay. So A, you behaved way too well and now I still have a little time. But B, striking that all of, I really would say that after the conversation we did just had, I wasn't expecting four hopefuls. So as we go out with, you know, 30 seconds left, and I think, I'm not picking favorites here, I just, Chris Wears, we started with music, so I want to finish with music because it's the place where so much AI has happened already. Is AI going to create some musician, the likes of which we've never imagined yet?
I would say yes, but, you know, coming back to Joel's point earlier, I perceive it more as a tool than as a replacement.
All right. On that note, Christopher Wares, Assistant Chair of the Music Business and Management Department at Berklee College of Music, Joel Christian Gill, Inaugural Chair of BU's MFA Program in Visual Narrative, Scott Neekum, Associate Professor in the College of Information and Computer Sciences at UMass Amherst, and Sean Clark, Assistant Professor and Department Chair in the Department of Visual and Media Arts at Emerson College. So much enjoyed learning from all four of you today. Thanks for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good to be here.